From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. My guest is Drew Friedman. He's an artist and historian of popular culture whose illustrations have appeared in countless publications, including Raw, Heavy Metal, New Yorker, Weirdo, Spy, and National Lampoon. He's published many collections, including a beautiful new book called Shtick Figures, The Cool, The Comical, The Crazy. He's also the subject of a new film called Drew Friedman, Vermeer of the Borscht Belt. Drew Friedman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
It's really a pleasure to meet you. I've enjoyed your work for years.
Thank you.
And it was the kind of work that stuck out of, I guess you would say, the underground comic world where you first got started. Where was your first work published?
Well, I guess it was the extension of the underground comics world. My first work was actually published in Screw Magazine in around 1980, and I actually put Shemp Howard on a cover of one of the issues. I somehow got away with that. But I also was I went to the School of Visual Arts, and one of my teachers was Art Spiegelman, who was starting a new magazine called Raw. Mm-hmm. And he used several of his students, including me, in the first issue and subsequent issues. So that was basically like where people started first seeing my work in Raw, and then eventually in Robert Crumb's magazine, Weirdo.
Right, Weirdo. Is that where I saw Ernest Borgnine and Ethel Merman's honeymoon?
I think that was in National Lampoon a little later. And then I did a comic for Heavy Metal featuring Ernest Borgnine, where in the future, everybody in Baltimore will look like Ernest Borgnine. that's included in my first anthology.
Well, you know, I think one of the things I love about your work, Drew Friedman, is that you capture everything that we love and hate about celebrities in the same drawing.
Well, yeah, I don't set out to get anybody. Like, I don't have this, you know, there are celebrities I dislike, but, you know, I don't feature that. Like, you know, politicians is different. That's a different category. But with celebrities, like, I lean towards the downtrodden, the forgotten, which is why I did features, comic strips about Tor Johnson, you know, the zombie, the Hollywood zombie, the big fat Hollywood zombie who was in schlocky films in the 50s. And a guy like Joe Franklin, who was like a talk show host in New York City, you know, on Channel 9 late at night, who just showed old films and had like plumbers as guests on his shows and things like that. So, you know, the people that nobody else would notice are the people I try to focus on for the most part.
When you do, you know, well-known celebrities like, say, Jerry Lewis. I mean, I love Jerry Lewis. I really love him. He's the greatest, but he's also horrible. And you get both of those things.
One of my favorite quotes about Jerry Lewis came from the comedy historian Cliff Nesterhoff. Hmm. Jerry Lewis is the comedian you love to hate and hate to love. And I think that sums him up.
Really
and,
did.
You know, I always loved Jerry Lewis growing up as a kid, but I also appreciated the schlockiness, you know, the Vegas side of Jerry Lewis and the telethons. And, you know, like I loved it. I loved the good and the bad. Like, you know, to me, people usually hate Jerry Lewis or they love him. For me, it's like, you know, there's no in between. I love him and I understand people who hate him. Yeah. I never argue the point. You know, I have good friends who absolutely despise him. But I never argue with them. I say, I get it. I understand why you would hate him, but you know, I don't.
I don't either. I mean, he makes me laugh. So that's the thing.
He always did when I was a kid. And then, you know, I've drawn him over the years. And then I actually drew the piece in Spy magazine about the day the clown cried in the 80s, the notorious piece they wrote about the day the clown cried, you know, years before, you know, it ever like surfaced, which it did recently in that documentary.
Oh, the film itself has surfaced, and we haven't seen it yet.
Well, there's a documentary about it, which includes a lot of footage from the film, about a half an hour's worth of footage. Mm. And it was on TCM, I think, last week.
Oh,
and Jerry was interviewed for it. It's a pretty good documentary, and it was interesting to see some of that footage. And as I always predicted, that it was not going to be the worst film ever made. It was like a misfire, but it's interesting, and it's sincere. And Jerry is like, he sounds like he's from Irvington, New Jersey, but still, you know, okay, he's a pretty good actor in it. So, you know, I'm not defending it. A lot of people hate, you know, like it's kind of embarrassing and it's a misfire, basically. But there it is. And Jerry finally distanced himself from the film and, you know, admitted it wasn't good work.
Well, that's interesting because I remember when he was hoping for a release and thinking he had missed his
Oscar. Early on, he was dedicated to, you know, he thought it was going to like be his serious film, his comeback film, the serious film. People would take him seriously. It wasn't going to happen.
It is interesting how personalities often want to be the one thing they're not. You know, Groucho Marx, for instance, wanted to be recognized as a great writer, even though he was the funniest guy. You know, every word out of his mouth was hilarious, and yet...
You're right. He wasn't quite satisfied with that, but he associated with his best friends were writers and songwriters, but, you know, serious writers, and he wanted to be part of that world, and he was a good writer. He wrote humorous books, lots of them, biographies, and, you know, and he wrote for The New Yorker for a while. But yeah, like comedians want to be taken seriously and serious actors want to be taken, you know, they want to be funny, you know, it's like never satisfied.
Well, do you want to have paintings hanging in the museum?
No, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, I've had things hanging in gallery shows and things like that, but none of that is important to me. You know, if it happens, it's fine. You know, it'll probably happen after I'm gone.
Well, that's a long way off. Tell me a little bit about your childhood. Your father is a well-known writer, Bruce J. Friedman.
Yeah, he died a couple of years ago, but he was one of these writers who just did a lot of, he did everything. He wrote short stories, he wrote fiction, he wrote novels, he wrote nonfiction. He also wrote some shows, some plays. People remember his play Steambath that was on PBS in the mid-70s with Bill Bixby. Yes. Valerie Perrine.
Yes.
And then he was a screenwriter also, and his two most popular films were Stir Crazy and Splash. So, you know, he just did it all and he kept working, you know, to the end. He died at age 90 a couple of years ago.
He also wrote the short story that The Heartbreak Kid was based on. It's one of my favorite movies.
Right. Change of Plan, which was in Esquire, and that became the original Heartbreak Kid movie. We don't talk about the second version of The Heartbreak Kid.
Oh, God, no.
The Farrelly Brothers version.
I love the original. That's a great one.
Yeah, it's like a lot of people's, I don't know about their favorite film, but it's sort of hard to watch because it hasn't been released on DVD or it hasn't streamed. It's weirdly, the rights are tied up weirdly with a pharmaceutical company or something like that for some reason that bought the company. It's convoluted and complicated, but this company bought the movie company that made it, and so it hasn't really been released. So it's kind of a cult film, you know, although you can see it on YouTube.
I saw it, you know, when it opened.
Yeah, so did I. I went to a preview with my dad. And, you know, I can say this now. He wasn't that crazy about the ending because they changed his ending. In the short story, the original short story, the character that Charles Grodin played, he starts looking at the mother at the end of the film after he has Sybil Shepherd as his wife. He's at the wedding. He starts checking out the mother. And the mother is in the short story is kind of glamorous and a little older but sexy. And they changed that. They left that out. And my father was slightly annoyed by that, you know. So, but he still enjoyed the film. He enjoyed the film overall.
That is a better ending.
It's like, I don't think Neil Simon, who wrote the screenplay, really wanted to go there.
It's an unusual screenplay for Neil Simon because it's not full of jokes.
There's no jokes in it. It's like a jokeless screenplay from Neil Simon, which is very rare. But Neil Simon later wrote in an interview for Film Comment, or mentioned in a film comic, that he wrote it as if he was my dad. He said, I wrote this film as if I was Bruce J. Friedman. So, you know, that was, I think, a compliment. And a lot of people think, who don't like Neil Simon's plays or movies, but they love that film, you know, because it's just different. It's dark. It's dark and it's, you know, there's no jokes.
Yeah. Well, so you grew up with a father involved in the world of literature in Hollywood.
It was all around me. You know, his friends were other writers like Mario Puzo and Terry Southern and Joe Heller, Kurt Vonnegut, and David Newman, the screenwriter. So, you know, all those guys were around me. Plus, he also was a editor at a magazine company called Magazine Management in the 60s, early 60s and mid 60s, to make a living with three sons. And this company, Magazine Management, his office was right next door to Stan Lee's office, you know, because Marvel Comics were published by Magazine Management as well. So I, as a little kid, 5-6 years old, would visit my dad and make a beeline for the Marvel Comics office.
Wow,
and Stan Lee took a liking to me because he knew I liked to draw. So he predicted someday I would work for Marvel, which never happened.
It hasn't happened yet.
I dabble at it. You know, it's like I actually worked up there as an intern for like a week in, when I was 14. And that's the extent of my career with Marvel Comics, I think.
But Stan Lee liked you.
Yeah, he was Mr. Charm, and, you know, big smile, and he wasn't quite where he wasn't wearing his toupee yet, but he was charming as hell. And also he was trying to please my dad because my dad was having literary success at that point. So he was going out of his way to, like, you know, zero in on me and make me happy and just to, you know, kind of please my dad.
Drew Friedman in the film about you that just is coming called the premiere of the Borscht Belt. Your father appears and he drops a little line about Kurt Vonnegut where he says, "It's the one thing that I agreed with Kurt Vonnegut about." That Drew Friedman was a good artist. They didn't get along, or they disagreed.
No, they were actually, you know, they were friends. They were not close when they were younger. As they got older, they became very friendly, close friends. And same thing with Joe Heller. When they were younger, it was like, you know, these guys that with their large egos, they're a little testy, they're a little jealous, and, you know, if someone has a great success, when you get older, you forget about that stuff. You know, I've learned that. So, you know, later on, he became really tight with Kurt Vonnegut, and Kurt wrote the introduction to one of my brother and my second book that I wrote with my brother, Warts and All, and Kurt Vonnegut graciously wrote the introduction to that. So that's it.
There it is, Warts and All. I love this book. This book, Warts and All, contains the aforementioned Ethel Merman and.
That's right. Do you have the embossed cover?
I can feel the warts and all.
Okay. So everybody can enjoy that, including blind people.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to hold it up for the radio audience to the microphone. Yeah,
that was our second book published by Penguin. Kurt Vonnegut did the foreword, and he did the foreword because my dad kept running into him in New York, and Kurt would bring me up. He said, "Oh, your son Drew, I really love your son Drew's work. I see it in Raw magazine and Robert Crumb's Weirdo magazine." Vonnegut was tight with Robert Crumb, or friendly, and Crumb would send them weirdos. So that's how he knew my work. So that's what it led to. But I don't know if my father was a fan of his work necessarily. Maybe that's what that line was about. First, you know, I don't know if he ever even read any of Kurt's books. I really don't know. I'm guessing he did.
As an illustrator, you and Kurt Vonnegut would be the polar opposites. In that he draws something for about 10 seconds, and I'm assuming that it takes you much longer to do your work than that.
Yeah, I would guess yes. I would guess you're correct. I mean, lately I really put in weeks and weeks into things. I mean, because I'm taking my time now and I'm not working on deadlines, so I can just take my time. And I just did a Lenny Bruce, for instance, Lenny Bruce and a Rod Serling, and it took weeks and weeks to do. I just kept noodling, you know, that's the word for it. Just kept going back and noodling. So,
now, when you do, you know, you're going to do a drawing of Rod Serling. Do you have a photograph that you're working from, or several photographs, or how do you
probably probably several? You know, I have to decide what era Rod Serling, and you know, I obviously was leaning towards Twilight Zone era. Although Night Gallery era Rod Serling's interesting because he wore a giant toupee at that point.
Oh,
but it was too much hair to even draw. It was like, you know, it was over the top wig. You know, at that point. And sadly, he died young at age 50. But
right.
So I leaned, you know, I did the, yeah, but I usually have a bunch of drawings, and I refer to different ones and use different poses with different faces, things like that. You know, I have a bunch, you know, I mean, it's so easy to pull reference these days. So, but I'm very particular about what I use. The shadowing and the lighting has to be right in the photograph I'm using, things like that.
The interesting thing about toupees, since you mentioned them, is have you ever looked at someone's toupee and not immediately said, "Oh, look, he's got a wig on"?
No, I have toupee dar. Yeah, I can zero in and guess when someone, and it's not even a guess. I just zero in and I know when someone's wearing a toupee. I have a knack for that. That's one of my talents. I also have Jew dar. I can always figure out when someone's
Jewish.
You know. Well,
let me ask you about that. But I am the same way. I was watching Holiday Inn the other night, and I said, "Oh, look, it's both dueling toupees, Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire."
That's right. That's well, Fred Astaire was pretty obvious, and Bing too at one point. And then it's actually funny. There's a video, I think it's on YouTube, where Jerry Lewis is going after Bing Crosby on the Colgate Comedy Hour, and he's determined to rip Bing Crosby's toupee off. And Bing Crosby knew it because I think Jerry had done it once before. So he's actually running away from him in fear.
But let me ask you about Judaism. So I know that many of the people you admire are Jewish, and you are Jewish, and I'm Jewish for that matter. But do you have a, is it just like a sort of a thing? Is there a, do you have a pride in Jewish heritage, or it's just something that's part of who you are?
I think, well, it's part of who I am, and I do have a pride, and I can't imagine being anything but Jewish. I mean, you know, I'm 66, and I've been Jewish all my life, and my parents were not overly Jewish. We had Christmas tree at Christmas time. My brothers and I were not bar mitzvahed. We weren't overly Jewish. I mean, we'd go to seders and bar mitzvahs, and I enjoyed them because I got to look at all those old crazy relatives, and these are guys who looked like Shemp Howard. You know, it's like I just took that in. But at an early age, I realized most of the comedians I really loved were Jewish, happened to be Jewish. You know, it was just a fact. Like the Marx Brothers, Three Stooges, Jerry Lewis, Milton Berle, Sid Caesar, Phil Silvers, just one after another. That's not to say I don't love Jackie Gleason and Art Carney and Richard Pryor and lots of non-Jewish comedians. So I'm not locked into that. It's not automatic, but just so many. And that's what led me to do a book of just Jewish comedians, you know, great Jewish comedians and not so great Jewish comedians. Well, and one book led to a second book, and the second book led to a third book.
Well, it is interesting that the film industry and the comic book industry were both founded and run by Jews.
Yeah, it is. And I can't explain that, you know, the comic book industry. Yeah, I can't explain that really, like how that happened, but it's true. They were all Jewish. I think Daryl Zanuck was like the only guy who wasn't Jewish in the film early film industry. Every single one of the other ones, I believe the Warner Brothers were Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly the comic book industry was founded by Bill Gaines' father, Max Gaines, in the mid-30s. He just figured out, like, just put a bunch of comic strips, newspaper comic strips together, bind them together. And that was the first comic book. But yeah, all Jews.
Yeah,
and not all the artists were Jewish, but the, you know, the publishers
and many of the creators, and Siegel and Schuster and Jack Kirby and
yeah, Will Stanley. Eisner, and you know, down the line, it was just, you know, maybe because it was in New York and it was like, you know, like near the garment industry when that was all going on, but you know, it's just a fact.
I also think it has something to do with the fact that it is a looked down upon industry, which is true of film also. Film was like the legitimate stage was great, and film was trash, and
yeah,
comic books,
well, yeah, yeah,
were less than comic strips. You know, the comic strip artists like Milton Caniff and people like that are not Jews, and the comic book artists were.
It's true. I was looked down on, and maybe that's why I gravitate towards it, like celebrating that the comic book industry was looked down on at the beginning. And I did two books like celebrating the people who created comic books. Yeah, that's true. You know, you say like, well, it was like that. It was like one step above the theater. But, you know, the theater was looked down on at the beginning. You know, people like thought it was like, you know, like down there with prostitution practically. When people wanted to be actors, they were just like frowned. It was frowned upon, you know, just the thought of being an actor.
And I guess that's true of artists, too. I mean, did you have the support of your family when you decided to become a professional artist?
Very much so, from both my parents, especially my mother, who, like, you know, always made sure I had art supplies, new art supplies, and sent me to art classes after school. Very supportive of whatever artistic endeavor my brothers and I wanted to get involved with. And my older brother Josh, wanted to be a musician and also was a writer. So they were always supportive of that. I mean, I never even imagined that I would actually go to work and get a job and like that. I always, like, I started drawing early on, and I just never stopped. You know, like so many people would stop, you know, you draw when you're a kid and then you give it up and you become a person, you become an adult, you get a real job. I never did.
Well, you were always a prolific drawer, as I guess is a good word to say. And I think when I first saw your work, you were doing this stippling that you would use a rapidograph. Is that what you used to do that?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I stumbled upon that. I didn't know what they were, but my mother actually was, after my parents divorced, my mother was dating a guy who was like a kind of a non-professional artist, but he had a lot of great art supplies. But he died, you know, sadly at a young age, and all his art supplies went to me, including this carousel of rapidograph pens. And I had no idea what they were, but I started experimenting with them and realized that I could just create this, like, you know, intensely thin line with a rapidograph pen, and little by little started to like doing this little stippling inside my drawings. And what that did was really slow me down, because I was drawing too fast. This is, you know, I was like 17, 18. I was drawing too fast. And I was aware of that. I need to slow down. And the rapidographs really helped me slow down. And the stippling style also. And I also realized, like, no other cartoonists were really doing the stipple style. So I thought, well, this might set me apart a little bit if I do that. So that's when I started working. When I was still going to school, I started doing that. And, you know, I stuck with that for about 10 years until I got bored with it.
Do you still use rapidographs when you work?
No, I don't. I don't think I even have any. No, I became addicted to the brush. So now everything's with the brush. I mean, I still rule out lines with markers and things, but I just like slowly, you know, it's an evolution. You know, I stuck with the stipple, although it slowed me down. I got bored with it, and I was getting so many assignments, I had to work faster. So I started experimenting with the brush and ink and paints and color, and, you know, so just continuing to evolve, basically.
Do you pencil your work first?
Yeah, real tight pencil at first, and then I'll take that to finish, and I'll just paint right on top of that. Yeah. But I'll spend a couple of days on the pencil, tight pencil, and just paint on it, and the pencil just disappears.
Interesting. So. Yeah. Well, and it's always beautiful work, and I love the way you focus on, as you were saying earlier, the sort of forgotten or lesser known people. And even when you do in your new book, which is called Shtick Figures, there's a beautiful portrait of Bud Abbott. I mean, I would think most people would draw Lou Costello, but you drew Bud Abbott, and you captured all the things that are wonderful about Bud Abbott in that drawing.
Thank you. The reason I drew that Bud Abbott is because I wanted him to be the first person. The book is alphabetical, So Bud Abbott is first. Because if I didn't draw Bud Abbott, the first guy in the book would have been a guy named Kurt Anderson, who was the editor of Spy Magazine, you know, who wrote a foreword to one of my books. He's the guy who actually coined the Donald Trump, the small hands on Donald Trump. He's the first guy who pointed that out years ago in Spy Magazine, which is why he's in the book, because, you know, that's shtick.
Yeah.
But I didn't want him to be the first guy in the book. So I said, who alphabetically would come before Anderson? Well, Bud Abbott. So there you go. I've drawn Abbott Costello over the, you know, many times. And usually you expect Lou Costello, but, you know, it's like, you know, I never want to do what's expected.
See, now we have on our team, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out, the guy's name. That's what I want to find out, the guy's name.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
Now, Abbott, you going to be the manager of the baseball team?
Yes.
You know the guy's names?
Well, I should.
Well, now you tell me the guy's names on the baseball team.
I say, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
You ain't saying nothing to me yet. Go ahead and tell me.
I'm telling him.
You ain't said nothing yet. Go ahead and tell me.
Who's on first, what's on second, I don't know is on third.
You know the guy's names on the baseball team?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. Who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the guy's name.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for? I don't know.
Now, wait a minute. I'm
asking you who's on first.
That's his name.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
That's it. That's his name.
Well, you ain't said nothing. I ain't asked you nothing.
You did.
You know the guy's name on first base?
Sure.
Well, tell me the guy's name on first base.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who is on first, Lou?
What are you asking me for?
Now, don't get excited. I'm saying who.
I'm asking you a simple question. Who's on first?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who? Yeah. I'm asking you, what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no. What's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Don't mix up my
story. I'm not mixing up anybody. Now, what's the guy's name on first base?
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking.
Whoa. How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
I mentioned his name?
Yes.
I don't know anybody's name on the team. How could I mention a guy's name?
You did. You just mentioned it.
All right. What's the guy's name on third base?
No, what's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on first.
See what I mean? I didn't even mention a guy's name on third base.
Yes, you did.
All right, then. Who's playing third base?
No, who's on first?
I'm not asking you what's on first.
What's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know. He's third base. I don't know anybody on a baseball team.
You do. You mention their names.
I do?
Sure.
You got an outfield?
Well, naturally.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Well, go ahead. Tell me.
Tell you what?
Tell a fella's name.
Why?
Because I want to know. Because.
Oh, he's center field. You know these players as well.
Who's in center field?
No, who's on first?
What's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know. Third base. Do you know the guy's names on the team?
Look, Louis, you don't seem to understand. See, I have a first baseman.
I know you got a first. I ask you, what's the first baseman's name?
No, what's the second baseman's
name? I'm going to start asking you, sir. I ask you, what's the first baseman's name?
What's the second baseman?
I don't even get past the first. All right, who's on second?
Who's on first?
What base do you want to talk about?
You talk about anyone you want to talk about.
All right, now who's on first?
Right.
Okay.
No.
All right, you got a first baseman.
Yes.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Every dollar of it.
Who gets it?
He does. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. Why not, Lou? He's earned it.
Who did?
Yes.
Look, when you pay off the first baseman every month, you get a receipt from the guy?
Sure.
How does he sign his name?
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
Well, that's how he signs it.
That's
Lou.
How who signs it?
Yes.
Go ahead, tell me.
That's it.
Who? Look, you go to first baseman.
Yes.
And you say to him, here's your money, sign the receipt. How does he sign his name?
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
That's how he signs it.
That's how who signs it?
Yes.
Sure. You gotta get a receipt from the guy, don't you?
Get one, Lou.
How does the guy on first base sign his name?
Who?
The guy on first.
That's how he signs
it. I'm asking, when you give the guy the money, what's the guy's name that you give the money to?
Now, wait a minute. What signs his own?
Who signs his own?
No, who signs his?
I mean, what's the guy's name on first you get the...
What is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
The fielder's name, the center field. I don't know if... You got a pitcher on the team?
Well, this must be a fine team without a pitcher.
It's a fine team without any... The pitcher's name.
Tomorrow. I can't change that name.
You don't want to tell me today?
I'm telling you.
Go ahead. Tell me the pitcher's name.
Tomorrow.
Why not tell me today?
I'm telling you.
Tomorrow? Then tell me the pitcher's name.
Tomorrow.
All right, what time tomorrow you tell me the pitcher's name?
What time what?
What time tomorrow you going to tell me who's pitching?
Who is not pitching?
I'll break your arm, you say, who's on first. I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know. Third base.
Sometimes when I watch their baseball routine, I have the clip from the television show. If you keep your eyes on Abbott, it's amazing to watch him work. He's probably the greatest straight man ever. Well, he had to be a good actor to be able to do it the way he does it.
We agree. Yeah, he was. He was a great straight man. He was, I think, probably the greatest. But like you, I tend to look at like when I watch the Three Stooges, I tend to watch Larry, you know, who's just in the background usually painting a wall. Not involved, getting slapped for no reason. But I focus on Larry. I always have. That's more fascinating to me than, you know, Mo and Curly. And then, of course, Shemp is in a category by himself.
Well, not only did Shemp have a great career outside the Three Stooges, but he was notoriously the ugliest man in Hollywood. So I guess it's good fodder for your drawing style.
Well, yeah, I've always been attracted to him because, like I said, he reminded me of some of the old crazy relatives I used to see at seders and bar mitzvahs. And that wobbly gait and that pockmarked face. And you did a great interview with Bert Kearns recently for his Shemp book, which I absolutely loved.
That's a good book.
And I was honored to do the foreword to that book. And I loved his book so much, I actually went back and rereading right now the Lawrence Tierney book that he wrote, which I also love.
Also excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. In fact, I'm talking to him recently, and he's considering doing a book on Richard Deacon, a biography of Richard Deacon.
I love Richard Deacon.
And there's never been a biography of him. And so I'm kind of pushing him to do that.
Right.
I don't know if it's going to happen, but I'd love it to happen because Richard Deacon had this whole secret life that most people are not aware of.
Well,
I'm not going to get into right now, but
I just remember him on television, but I don't know anything about his secret life.
Yeah. Well, you'll find out. Well, he was, you know, one of these guys who simultaneously was on Leave It to Beaver and Dick Van Dyke Show at the same time. That was rare.
Yeah.
Like two major network shows he had parts on.
I ran into him once at a theater and said hello.
Was he friendly?
Very friendly, very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that'll be a fascinating book.
Yeah.
And also, he wrote cookbooks about how to cook with a microwave. And so he's ahead of the curve in the '70s.
One of the guests that I had on From the Bookshelf was Ronnie Schell, comedian, who also had two simultaneous network shows on two different networks. He was on Gomer Pyle, and he was also on That Girl.
Wow.
And also on That Girl was Ted Bessel, or Ted Bessel, or whatever his name was. And he had his own show, which your father was one of the writers of that show.
Well, he did. It was a pilot in the early 70s called The Ted Bessel Show. And Bill Persky, who was the producer of That Girl and Dick Van Dyke Show, great writer. He's still around. He's 94.
Wow.
If you'd like to talk to him, he'd probably be a great guest. But my dad collaborated on the Ted Bessel Show. So it was just a pilot. It didn't air. It aired a couple years later on CBS, but it didn't go forward.
He was an unusual, he also died young, but he was an unusual character in television.
He was on Mary Tyler Moore a couple of times. He played her boyfriend. He was very, I talked to him once on the phone. He was a sweet guy. One of the perks of being the son of my dad is some of these people would call. So I had great conversations with Ted Bessel, Bud Cort, and then not a great conversation with Bette Midler. She was just not in the mood to, like, you know, talk to a 15-year-old kid.
Too bad. Well, I know.
But sometimes Tony Randall called and I couldn't get him off the phone. And he was calling for my dad, who wasn't home. So I talked to him. He wouldn't stop. He was just great.
Interesting. Isn't that great? Well, I did meet Groucho once. I was in a passenger seat of a car, and I saw him. We were driving in Beverly Hills, and I saw him on the street, and I said, pull over. And I ran half a block to catch up with him, and I said, Mr. Marks, I hate to bother you while you're on your walk, but I wanted to meet you all my life. He says, I don't blame you.
I don't blame you. What year would that have been?
74.
Okay. I met him in 75. Actually, I met him three times. Uh-huh. I encountered him three times. Yes. First time was at the show Minnie's Boys that came out in 1970. Right. He was the consultant on that show, the show about the Marx Brothers with Shelley Winters. Not a great show, but I enjoyed it, but I was 11.
Yes.
But Groucho was there in the audience, and at intermission, like, people were just going up to him, getting his autograph, and it was impossible to get up, you know, to get close to him, because there were just, like, mobs of people around him. So I was only 11, so I crawled through people's legs to get up to him and shoved my playbill right in his face, and he signed it, and I still have that.
That was nice. The
first time. Then he came to see, he was doing ads for Teacher's Scotch, which was a kind of shady scotch that was, they were getting celebrities. They had Georgie Jessel and Groucho Marx, Jack Benny, I think, George Burns, to do ads for them. So those Teacher Scotch threw a party for Groucho Marx in 1973 in New York, early 73. And my dad was invited. So he brought me, and Groucho was there with his girlfriend, Erin Fleming. And Groucho and my dad had a little talk. Groucho said he had just seen The Heartbreak Kid and loved it. So, you know, my dad introduced me to him. And then the third time was the charm. It was when we were invited to Groucho's house in the Hollywood Hills, and we spent the whole day there. And I talk about that in the film, in the Vermeer of the Borscht Belt, directed by Kevin Dougherty, by the way.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that. Yeah.
So I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, we spent the whole day there with Groucho and actually put him to bed. As he got into his pajamas, we tucked him in. And he was going to bed early because he was watching You Bet Your Life. It was back in reruns. And it was being syndicated for the first time in years, and he was watching it every night.
Wow.
It was very, very sweet.
Isn't that funny? How great. In your film, also, you talk about Lou Jacoby, and I'm a huge Lou Jacoby fan. I love Lou Jacoby. He was an actor and a very funny one, and I remember him in particular in a movie that I loved called Next Stop Greenwich Village, directed by Paul Mazursky, in which he runs a health food juice bar. You had a poison sandwich for lunch yesterday, am I right? And he's also great.
You do a great Jacoby.
Thank you. He's also great in everything you've always wanted to know about sex, but we're afraid to ask, the Woody Allen film where he plays a transvestite who gets caught, and his wife says to him, honey, you could have told me. You could have explained to me. You could have said, I'm a sick person.
Very good. I haven't seen that in years. One of Woody Allen's early funny films.
That's right. But Lou Jacoby, one of my favorites.
He was great. He pops up in Little Murders, too. He's the judge in that.
That's right.
He's also in Irma LaDouche as the bartender. I think this first film, he was amazing. He was all over the map. He was in theater and movies and TV. He was on the Dean Martin show. He was a regular. And so a couple of years ago, somebody contacted me just on Facebook and said, "Hey, Drew, I just bought all the archives of a comedian, a Jewish comedian named Lou Jacobs. Would you like them?" And I said, "I don't know who Lou Jacobs is." So this guy went back and looked at all the stuff. He said, "I'm sorry, his name is Lou Jacoby." "Oh, Lou Jacoby. Yes, I love Lou Jacoby. Since I was a little kid, I saw him in Norman Is That You on Broadway in 1970. I loved Lou Jacoby. Yes, I'd be happy to take his archives." And so I traded. He all he wanted to do was trade me a piece of artwork. So he shipped me the archives, four boxes of Lou Jacoby's archives. But I wondered how they wound up at a flea market in outdoor flea market in Georgia when Lou Jacoby lived in New York City on Central Park West. He had died a few years before. He had no children. His wife died before him. Little by little, I started to figure things out. Like somehow his archives, including his scrapbooks, his photographs, his publicity photographs, letters, tributes from his friends and telegrams, et cetera, records, tapes, cassettes. Everything he owned were in these boxes. I wondered how they wound up in Georgia. So I just like tried to figure things out, and like either his caretaker stole everything, or the stuff just wound up in a dumpster and somebody dumpster dived it and found it, and somehow it wound up down in Georgia, and then it wound up with me, and I still have it, and I don't want to sell it, I don't want to profit on it, but I still have it, and you know, it's part of my Jewseum of comedy. And it's not going anywhere. I'm not selling. I'm not going to put it up on eBay. I want it all to stay together as a collection. But anyway, I own all that stuff. It's amazing. It's amazing to go through.
That's so great. Well, maybe I can join you one
it's
day.
I think it's a happy ending. I think you would be happy to know I have it.
Now you have it. Yeah, of course.
And it's going to go to the right place, you know, the place it belongs.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, and you have a marvelous way of, I mean, I love your art, so, but you just get that, you capture their essence. I saw a drawing you did of Maurice Gosfield, who played Doberman on Bilko. I love that guy. He was a fantastic comedian. And again, he has to be a good actor to play the part that he played on the show.
Like, yeah, he was a character, and, you know, he was, you know, Phil Silvers wound up not liking him so much because he would get more fan mail than Phil Silvers. So, you know, a little by little, it was like, you know, he became so big and it went to his head. And, you know, but after Bilko, there wasn't much going on for him. He actually did one of the voices on Top Cat, the animated show, Benny the Ball, which was based on the character he did on Bilko. And then he auditioned for the Addams Family for Uncle Fester, but then he died. Mm. You know, of course, Jackie Coogan got that, but he's fascinating, you know, this guy. And I would watch that show mostly for Maurice Gosfield, you know, just like I'd watch Car 54, Where Are You, for Joey Ross.
Ooh.
Yeah, I still watch that. You know, it's like my wife and I love that show.
I also loved his later show, It's About Time, was also.
Of course, with Imogene Coca.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love Car 54, Where Are You. I love the Munsters when I was a little kid, and now I can hardly watch it. You know, it just has Car 54 with Al Lewis and Fred Gwynn is just so superior. The writing, and it all comes down to Nat Hiken, the creator of that show, and Bilko.
Yes,
that's just right. Like the most brilliant guy who ever worked in TV comedy.
I think so. Fred Gwynn is in a few Bilkos as well.
Yeah. He plays a guy who can just eat and eat and eat. I think he's called The Stomach.
That's right.
Yeah, he's great in it. You see early Dick Van Dyke in a Bilko too, and Alan Alda.
Yeah.
He pops up in early when he was very young, like 19, 20.
I think Paul Ford is hilarious, who plays Colonel Hall.
He's great. He's great. He's great in The Music Man as well.
That's right. That's right. He's in The Music Man.
Mayor Shin.
we have much the same taste, Drew Friedman.
I think so.
In performers. Arnold Stang. I love Arnold Stang.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's in my new book. I left him out of my old Jewish comedian books, and I regret that, but I drew him young. Now that I'm becoming an old Jew, you know, I'm not in such a rush to draw people as old people anymore. But I drew Arnold Stang as a young man in my new book.
Stang, I love him. He was Top Cat, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure, yeah, he could do a great Phil Silvers, but it was also, you know, he was Top Cat, and he did animated voices back in the 1940s, like Popeye cartoons and Herman and Catnip.
Oh, Herman and Catnip.
Pretty amazing career.
Yeah. And he's in.
I never got to meet him. I did meet a lot of these guys when my Jewish comedian books came out, And I heard from a few of them, you know, who were all delighted except for one guy, Jack Carter, who was always angry. And sure enough, he was angry at the way I drew him in the book. And he was interviewed for the Los Angeles Times. They were doing a piece on the book. And he was just angry. He's just like, I don't like how he drew me. With they made my hair look like my hair look like it's thinning. And he gave me liver spots. And you tell him to draw me again. He was angry.
I never met Arnold Stang. I did meet Marvin Kaplan once. Had dinner with Marvin.
Yeah,
Kaplan.
I heard he was a sweet guy. Very Everybody nice. Who met him. Sometimes you hear these things about these guys, and they were just the greatest guys. I got to know Larry Storch pretty well, and he couldn't have been sweeter. Just the friendliest, nicest man.
Lived a long life, didn't he?
Yeah, he made it to 99. Yeah, sweet, sweet guy, sweet guy.
These are the people we love.
Yeah,
and if you
when the first book came out, I would get phone calls. Like first, Freddie Roman called, and he loved the book. And then Mickey Freeman called, who was on the Bilko show too. He was a little guy he was a blonde haired guy with the crew cut.
Yeah,
Fielding Zimmerman. And then Jerry Lewis called, and that was like, you know, I was on my back because I had sprained my back, and my wife said, Jerry Lewis is on the phone.
Oh my gosh.
And I thought he was going to be angry because I didn't put him on the cover. And I put Milton Berle on the cover. I thought Jerry was going to be angry, but he gets on the phone. He goes, Drew Friedman? Yeah. He goes, I got your book. I go, okay, did you like it? He says, I loved it. Jesus Christ, it was great. boy, was I relieved. And we struck up a friendship. He would call me every once in a while and ask what I was working on, things like that.
How wonderful. Well, that's a dream come true, isn't it?
I guess so. Yeah. Some of the other guys would call too. And I wasn't in the mood to pick up because it would be like they would test their jokes on me. and they were never funny, you know. But, you know, I would like, try to laugh.
I went to see Sinatra a few times, and once the opening act was Jan Murray, and it was the most unfunny hour I've ever spent watching this guy. And you know, the audience laughed anyway, but nothing he said was remotely funny.
Yeah, I believe you. And I, you know, Jan Murray is like in the episode of Car 54, one of the funniest episodes they ever did, the Boom Boom episode, if you remember that.
Yeah.
He was not, you know, I'm not going to criticize him because I never saw him live, you know, and he was popular in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s and movie actor as well. But, you know, I've mentioned before that I love funny comedians and I love unfunny comedians. And one of my favorite comedians who's never made me laugh once is Georgie Jessel. I'm just fascinated by the guy who had this amazingly long career.
Yes.
On Broadway, he was in the original Jazz Singer. He turned down the movie role. Al Jolson got it. Just amazing career, long, long, legendary career. Never funny for a second, but I love the guy. I can't get enough of him.
He was a singer.
I mentioned once, yeah. I was with Robert Klein once, and I mentioned, like, you know, I love funny comedians. I also love unfunny comedians. And he looked at me like he was angry. And then I clarified, like Georgie Jessel. And it just a big grin went on his face. Like, he got it.
That's funny. Yeah, well, you know, I think it really is interesting when the moment of death turns out to be important in terms of a person's memory, because when Jolson died in 1950, I think it was, he was at his peak of his fame due to the movie The Jolson Story and the sequel Jolson Sings Again. And at the cemetery where Jolson is buried, there's a gigantic statue to Jolson, which is like not something that Jewish cemeteries usually do. You know, they don't have gravestones or any of those things. But it's like a memorial temple to Jolson.
I've seen it, yeah. I mean, I've seen photos of it.
Yeah, and in the same cemetery is Jessel, and he's just got a little, you know, he's up in a tomb, and there's a little George Jessel.
Interesting.
Just a little thing. I mean, if he had died in 1927, they'd probably have a big statue for him.
Yeah, or even 1937 or 47, because he was, you know, he continued to be a big star on Broadway. He was in early movies, Warner Brothers movies, and shorts.
Yes.
And, you know, he was like a major, major guy, and as was Eddie Cantor back then, and he's like completely forgotten.
Yeah, Cantor.
And Eddie Cantor's another guy, I can't really stomach him. I get it, I know what people love him, but, you know, he's pretty much forgotten, you know. Not a bad thing to be forgotten. Fanny Bryce is pretty much forgotten. Barbara Streisand as Funny Girl is like, people remember that, but they don't remember the actual Fanny Bryce, just like they don't remember Joey Lewis. They know they kind of remember Frank Sinatra playing Joey Lewis. Not even that so much.
Well, that's one of those movies.
But Joey Lewis, one of these guys, I put him on the cover of my second Jewish comedian book, but he never made movies really. He was in a couple of films in the 40s, small parts. But he's one of these comedians who just wanted to always be in a nightclub because that's where you drink.
Right, so. Yeah. I heard him tell a good joke, though. He said, he was talking about Sophie Tucker. And he said, she's a wonderful woman. You know, she entertained the troops until she was captured by the Confederacy.
Very good. He was great. But, you know, film never really captured him, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, you kind of wonder, why was he so popular, a guy like that? You know, but he was a nightclub comedian.
We're talking with Drew Friedman, and he's one of the great illustrators, and his new book is called Shtick Figures. And I don't mean illustrator to say that he's not an artist. Do you feel there's a difference between artist and illustrator?
I'm fine with illustrator. I used to, you know, call myself a cartoonist, and I said, all right, I'm going to get a little fancier. I'll call myself an illustrator, but I'm fine with that. You know, like I'm fine with that. Illustrator, pop culture, well, not authority, but enthusiast, I suppose. You know, I don't know how to label myself.
Well, artist is an appropriate one.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. When people call me artist, like, fine.
Well, Milton Berle, for instance, you know, there was a time when Milton Berle was the most famous person in America, maybe the most famous person in the known world. And I think, you know, most people have no idea, you know, young people have no idea who he is and why he was popular. And yeah, even when you look at the old kinescopes, it's hard to tell why people liked him.
Yeah, well, those early shows. Yeah, it was like, you know, it's basically all there was on television was Milton Berle. That's basically it, you know, until like the early 50s when Lucille Ball appeared and Martin Lewis and Jack Benny. But at first it was just Milton Berle. He was like Mr. Television. Mr. Tuesday Night, Uncle Milty, you know, so, you know, he was the guy, and he's the guy who figured out, like, okay, I'll go on that box, and you know, I'll become a huge star, which he did. And it's interesting because his radio show, which he did in 1947 before TV, was actually much better than the TV show. It was actually produced and written by Nat Hiken, who went on to do Bilko and Carr. And you can listen to it. It might be on YouTube or online. And it's just much, much sharper and weirdly surreal. And he's great. And Arnold Stang is one of the co-stars on it.
Oh.
And you know, people don't know that, don't realize it. And so most people are not interested anyway. You and I are.
Yes.
But, you know, it's like people are not, you know, it's like Milton who? It's like he had a pretty pretty big career into the 60s. He's on Batman into the 60s and 70s. And then he became, you know, kind of embarrassing. You know, when he was on Saturday Night Live, he was doing Puerto Rican jokes, if you remember that. And now he's one of these guys. Well. His entire legacy is his appendage. Yes. It comes down to that. You know, when people talk about Milton Berle, that's the first thing that comes up.
Famous thing.
He was the guy somehow. He was. I mean, there were a few of them, but he, you know, and I think he took pride in that too.
Okay.
He was on the Howard Stern show once in the 80s, and Howard only wanted to dwell on that one subject, Milton Berle's appendage.
Well, that's typical.
And Milton Berle, like, scolded Howard. He said, Howard, why don't you grow up? What kind of son did your mother raise? Let's talk about other things. So Howard, like, said, okay, Milton. And he changed the subject to, you know, TV or movies. Within 5 minutes, Milton Berle got the subject back to his appendage.
Well, I do love old radio programs. And I think I have listened to every single Jack Benny show from all the way back to, to into the 50s. And that program was also, I mean, I think if people would listen to it now, they would be shocked. Not only is it hilariously funny and incredibly well written, but layered with years long running gags that lasted forever. Mm-hmm. And that would just be brought out and sometimes only with sound effects. It was just an absolutely brilliant show. And
yeah,
Benny was brilliant.
But I would think that was the biggest comedy show on radio for you know, all those years, and segued into TV. And the TV show has quality too, but the radio show stands out. I agree. TV show actually ran till 1964, which is, you know, strange to think about.
Yeah.
It's also strange to think. This is the kind of things I think about, but Bob Hope comic books actually lasted till 1968.
Jerry Lewis, you know, comic books.
into the 70s. Yeah. You know, it was basically his career was washed up except for the telethon and the cartoon show on TV. But yeah, who was buying Jerry Lewis comic books in the 1970s? I guess it's still, and they're not very good. I have a few because I have a part of my museum. I now have a Jerry Lewis room, you know, which is just filled with Jerry Lewis mementos, posters, and you know, ephemera, Jerry Lewis ephemera. And I have some of the comics, and they're terrible. They're terrible. And, you know, some of them had good artists like Neil Adams and whatnot, but they're just, and Mort Drucker actually drew some of them. Mm. They're just terrible. And it's like, I wonder about the guys who had to write those things.
Maurice Gosfield had a comic. There's like 14 issues of Doberman.
He did. He did. I have a couple of those too. Yeah. Phil Silvers had, well, they, first it was the Bilko comic. Maurice Gosfield became so popular, they gave him his own comic. Yeah. Martin Lewis, Jerry Lewis comics. They started as Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis comics in the 50s. And then, you know, Dean had no interest in that stuff or, you know, couldn't care less. And they just continued as Jerry Lewis comics.
The adventures of, I like the use of the word adventure. For instance, the adventures of Ozzie and Harriet.
Yeah, adventures. Yeah, right.
They never have any adventures.
The adventures of Jerry Lewis. And I think they gave him a nephew years later, like, okay, you know. But it's like in 1972, the comic was still coming. He still had big white sneakers on, like he wore in the mid-50s. And, you know, he was still, like, you know, acting like an idiot. It was like, it wasn't quite clicking.
it's fabulous stuff. All my favorite things. How do you weigh in on the pointless debate about the Marx Brothers versus the Three Stooges?
I do think it's pointless. It's apples and oranges as far as I'm concerned. I love them both. I love the Marx Brothers and I love the Three Stooges. I don't love all of the Marx Brothers. I don't love all of the Three Stooges. But I appreciate Joe Besser and I appreciate Curly Joe DeRita, the later Stooge. Those were impossibly large shoes to fill, Curly Howard and even Shemp Howard. So, you know, it's like I have friends who like, you know, it's like, you know, well, I have a friend who hates the Beatles because he loves the Ramones. I said, can't you like them both?
Yeah, that's crazy.
You
know, I don't think that.
But it's the same with the Three Stooges. I have a friend, Scott Alexander, the screenwriter, who's like kind of likes the Three Stooges, but he's passionate about the Marx Brothers. You know, it's like, and he dismisses the Three Stooges and, you know, the fact that I love them. Like, I'm fine with that, you know, but I don't get it. It's apples and oranges.
I find it interesting today in 2025 that watching the Marx Brothers requires a certain level of intelligence knowledge that the Three Stooges don't require. That is, you can watch the Three Stooges and know nothing and enjoy it. But when Groucho says, friends, there's nothing like liberty except Collier's in the Saturday Evening Post.
It's not going to work these days. It's going to work with like diehard Marx Brothers fans, but the Three Stooges are just pure, brilliant slapstick. And plus the sound effects were just like perfection. you know, you can appreciate the Three Stooges like you can appreciate cartoons from the 1930s and 40s, old Bugs Bunny cartoons and Daffy Duck. They're like living cartoons where the Marx Brothers, they're more cerebral. It's like, you know, aside from Harpo, where, you know, he's universal. It's like, you know, but it's like a lot of puns, and some of those puns fall flat. And then you watch the really early Paramount films. I'm not criticizing the Marx Brothers. I love them. I'm fascinated by them. But, you know, there's always a pause between every joke, you know, because they did it that way, of course, because people were laughing in the movie theaters. So they had to pause, couldn't go right into them. So, you know, it's tricky. But I will say the Three Stooges continue or are more popular than ever, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, they're on MeTV every Saturday night. I think they're really popular, where the Marx Brothers are kind of forgotten. It's like people aren't, you know, into the Marx Brothers like they used to be. They had that whole revolution in the 70s, you know, because they, you know, they just people in the counterculture related to them. But now it's I think they've kind of gone adrift.
It is interesting how a lot of culture from the 30s and 40s became extremely popular again in the 60s and 70s when recreational drug use was at its zenith. Fantasia was not a success in 1940, but it was huge in 1968.
As big as 2001 A Space Odyssey, basically. You know, it's like, oh wow, you can you know, get high and watch these films. But, you know, even Busby Berkeley films became hugely popular in the late 60s, early 70s, and, you know, they'll come around again, I predict, and so will the Marx Brothers. You know, it just comes around every couple of decades, I suppose. You know, but, you know, some things are just going to go away and they're not going to come back. I can't, I'm not going to say what, but, you know, it's just like, that's it. I don't think there's going to be a big revival in Eddie Cantor. I just don't see it.
Probably not. But some of his early 20th Century Fox films, like Whoopi, are worth taking a look at.
Yeah, he was charming, and he was funny, and he was a good singer, and he actually introduced the song Santa Claus is Coming to Town on radio in 1932. Huh. First guy who sang that, and he does a beautiful job. It's on YouTube. You know, so I don't like to piss on him, but, you know, it's just like some of it is hard to watch, especially a little later. You know? Yeah, and then he had the Three Stooges on his TV show, which was nice. Oh, he actually had Abe Vigoda was on his TV show as a cab driver early on.
You're an Abe Vigoda fan.
Yeah, and I got to know him, too. He was a sweet guy. He came to the Society of Illustrators held a opening. They held a show of my Jewish comedian artwork. We had Abe Vigoda came to the opening, as did Joe Franklin, Al Jaffe, Robert Klein, Paul Schaefer, Gilbert Gottfried was there. It was a memorable night 10 years ago. And Abe was there and just had a ball. And he just sat there next to my dad for an hour, and people were just posing with him, and he was just having a ball. He was the sweetest guy.
Had his own TV show.
Yeah, I don't think I ever watched Fish. I enjoyed him on Barney Miller. I don't think I ever watched Fish, you know, but, you know, God bless him. He was, you know, so good in The Godfather, just so right. And Perfect. Then he segued right into Barney Miller, and, you know, and that, just became like, you know, an icon.
Yeah, a star at a very late.
And he had a long career. And interestingly, you know, you probably know this. His brother was a popular comic book artist who drew Archie Comics since the 40s. His brother was the success of the Vigoda brothers. He was the big success up until Abe appearing in The Godfather.
Those careers are interesting. And it's wonderful to see these people immortalized in your artwork, Drew Friedman, and your latest book, which I think is just a beautiful, beautiful book. And it's a big one. And it also has a raised surface.
Yeah, yeah, more embossing.
Yeah. The Cool, the Comical, the Crazy, Shtick Figures by Drew Friedman. It's a beautiful book, and
thank you.
Congratulations on it. And the film, which is coming soon, is called Drew Friedman, The Vermeer of the Borscht Belt, also extremely entertaining.
Again, directed by Kevin Dougherty, and Shout Factory produced it, and it should be streaming within a few months. And it's looking like there'll be a screening in Los Angeles and Hollywood in a couple of months with details to come on that.
Oh, good. Well, please let me know.
I shall.
But Drew Friedman, really a pleasure to meet you, and great talking to you. Thank you for making time for From the Bookshelf.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Gary. It's like, you know, it's such a pleasure to talk to somebody who gets it, a fellow traveler.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.